she and some other Al-Anon friends quite literally saved my life. So I'd like to introduce Karen Kay as our speaker.
I'm still shouted at quite a bit at home, so that rousing welcome might... Anyway, I'm Karen, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I attend the Friday Good Morning Al-Anon group, which meets at Bethel United on 5th and Monroe, Friday mornings at 10. Thank you, Richard, and your committee for asking me to tell my story. It's a privilege and an opportunity. And I always preface my story by saying it's my story. You may not like or even agree with what I have to say, and that's okay. It's my story, and it's how I've used the program of Al-Anon and the fellowship of the program to create and enhance my life or create a reasonably happy life. I've lived with active alcoholism for 42 years. I'm still there. The theme of your conference is Journey to Serenity, and I'm still on that journey. I'll tell you a little bit about who I am and what happened to me and what it's like now. And I'm quite a character. I joke around a lot, so if I get carried away, it's not because I'm making light of the seriousness of this disease, but my sense of humor has saved my sanity many a day. I'm the oldest of three children, and hardworking parents from large families. No alcoholism in my immediate family. My mother came from a lot of drinking. Her siblings drank a lot, partied a lot. I quite liked them, actually. They were like a bunch of monkeys when we all got together. And that sort of gave me a premonition of where I was going to go. My father was Irish, a real gentleman. I went to elementary school with Ursuline nuns. I met a couple of gals in the washroom, and I flipped my hair or something and nearly ripped off my earlobe, and I said I would finish off what Sister Eleanor started, because those nuns were on my earlobes all the time, because I like to talk and have fun. I learned very early that if I made people laugh, they often forgot my transgressions, and I made friends. So the nuns didn't really take kindly to this skill. They prided themselves in silence and control. We could hear the beads when they walked up the aisles. And so they were forever yanking on my ear and making me come back and sit with them. I was expected to conform and be a good girl. In those days, children were seen and not heard, and girls had to be proper and so on and so forth. And my parents followed that line of whatever, and the nuns, of course, certainly reinforced that. I grew up in, as I said, I was a real character, and the nuns didn't appreciate this skill, and oftentimes I would also be chewing gum in school, which was almost reason for a stroke. They would take the gum and stick it on the blackboard, and I'd have to put my nose in it and stand on my tiptoes during the class. Now, you try and do that and giggle at the same time, it's quite difficult, but I did it. And, of course, it created chaos in the classroom because the children all laughed, and then I was probably sent out in the hall. Now, for the more serious offenses, they had a rubber strap, and I think it was a piece of a tire. And they kept that in the principal's office, and I was also sent there quite often. I remember the first time I was about 10 years old, and we were writing a spelling test, and my classmate dropped her pen, and I bent down and picked it up and handed it back to her, and I was accused of cheating. I couldn't defend myself, off to the office and got the strap. I can still feel that tingling. I was absolutely, well, mortified. At the same time that I was going to school with these nuns, I was taking music lessons with other nuns, other Ursuline nuns. And unfortunately, the one I had was another abuser. And she, too, is on my earlobe. And if she wasn't pulling on my earlobe, she was tapping my knuckles with a steel-edged ruler to the beat of the metronome. And, of course, I'd start to cry. And then she'd say, oh, come on, you can smile. So now I learned to smile through tears. That also helped well later. When I told my parents what was going on at school, I was told if you get punished at school, you'll get punished at home. That was the rule. Now, my parents didn't beat us, but they found ways. And So then I thought, well, geez, I can't tell them. I've got nobody to defend me here, nobody to go to bat for me. I'm going to just not tell. So when I started getting the same treatment at the music lessons, I didn't tell them. I just took it, smiled through my tears. 8 years of that. Anyway, Elvis rescued me. When I turned 13, he was on the hit parade, and I would race home. Some of you may remember Pick a Pop on the radio. If you identified songs, you get free R45s and 78s and whatnot. And I was quite famous right across Saskatchewan for getting on this program and getting all these records. And, of course, I wanted to play Elvis. So you go to a party, nobody wants to hear Bach and Beethoven. And so I wanted to learn how to play Elvis music, and when I suggested this to Sister Eleanor, she nearly had a stroke. And that was the end of that. She phoned my parents, and there was quite a discussion, and I was released from the music lessons. I graduated from that school, and I went off to high school. And boys, I was quite shy. Some of you might find that hard to believe, but they were cute. And my skill at entertaining and laughing and cutting up, you know, helped out there as well. But I was as dumb as a bag of hammers or a bucket of bolts in math. And again, my school teachers didn't exactly appreciate my skill in entertaining and cutting up. And I can remember Mr. Rogers, do you remember him, Bernadette? Would come into the class and, there she is, that sassy little lassie. He was Irish and he'd pitch a chalk brush at me. And of course, I'd be embarrassed, but I'd smile, you know, laugh. And of course, the students would laugh. And that was high school. So obviously, I didn't really excel. And I was on the yearbook committee and the decorating committee and the social committee. And I was a cheerleader, so then I could chase around with the boys without, you know, with my parents' consent, follow all the teams around. So that was fun. When I graduated from high school, I took a job in a medical clinic, and I had lots of crazy things happen there, but that's all confidential, so I can't really tell you about that, but some of them, hilarious. Anyway, I decided I'd go into nursing. So off I went. I don't remember if I even checked into this. I jumped on a train and took off for Victoria. That's my life. My parents never knew whether I was going to walk or fly. And I got there, and of course I didn't have geotrachs, so I couldn't get in. So I started working in a drugstore there, and I had all kinds of antics. I was a stockroom clerk in the basement, and I had to wear high boots and all absorbing junior, and I don't know, it was wild. And one day, we were told by the pharmacist, if any men came in for prophylactics, I think that's the right name, we should send them to him. And of course, this particular day, a big ship, British ship, landed in Victoria with about 900 sailors, and they hit the streets. And of course, they came into the drugstore on the corner of Owl and Douglas, and they wanted to buy prophylactics. And I was the only one there at the counter, and I was just completely taken by these men in sailor outfits. I mean, really. And they asked me for safes. And I didn't know what to say. The pharmacist was gone for lunch, and I thought, well, what am I going to do? Tell them to come back later? And I was about 17, and they were having fun with this. I know very well they were. And we had two different size packages. I innocently asked them if they wanted large or small. Well, I don't even remember what happened, except I got a tongue lashing from the pharmacist as I was hanging up my smock or whatever and phoning my dad I was going to go home. I had enough of this. So anyway, I came home on the train. And I met a bunch of people on the train. They were having kind of fun, and I thought I wheedled my way into their corner, and we were playing cards and so on, and there was a character in there that had very little hair and no teeth. I remember he had holes in his jeans and his socks, and he was kind of disheveled, and he took a liking to me. So we chatted and whatever all the way back to Saskatchewan, and I'll never forget the look on my mother's face when I got off the train. This guy insisted on getting off the train and carrying my luggage. I think she thought he was her future son-in-law. Anyway, I'm back home, and I started working in the credit union in this town of Humboldt. And I had fun. I was now going to dances. I was free to date legally. And I was able to go to dances, and we had a fabulous time. In those days, they'd had big dance halls and lots of fun. And I had a friend in Regina who had gone ahead to university, and she kept bugging me to come and live in Regina with her. Well, I thought, isn't that exciting? Go to the big city. So off I went, got a job with SaskTel. And after a few months, I came home, and she said, you know, we haven't met any guys. Life is kind of boring, and, you know, we need to do something. And she said, they're auditioning for go-go dancers. Why don't we go and audition for go-go dancing? Well, I like dancing. We danced a lot. Well, I said, I'm not going to audition for the dancing, but I'll go along with you just as, you know, emotional or moral support. So off we went, and all I remember of that, there was all kinds of women milling around, and there was a band there, and there was a gorgeous guitar player, lead guitar player there, and I had my eye on him. And he started to play, they started to play, and the music was great, so I asked the choreographer if I could dance, and she said, well, if you dance, you have to put your name on the list. And I thought, well, there's no chance I'll ever get this anyway, so put my name on the list and danced my fool head off. Well, as it turned out, they did several eliminations, and I was in the eliminations, ending up to be one of the eight they chose, and my friend wasn't. Now, she was from England, she had bushy blonde hair, she was very well built, I was just a little stick then. And she danced like Mick Jagger. A whole lot of shaking going on, and they thought this was too, you know, this was a family show, I guess. And so the first night I danced with a gal from Toronto, and I didn't really have a good time. We were completely out of sync, and she was kind of a show-off anyway. And so I told them if I couldn't dance with Martha, or Marta, that I wasn't going to dance. So they hired her. So the two of us danced all over Saskatchewan with bands and jumped out of cakes at Chrysler conventions, or I don't know what all. Flatbed trucks and opening of malls. Oh, it was wild. We got tangled up with the midgets in Gravelburg, I think. That's another story. Anyway, when the wagon train went across, do you remember that wagon train that went over? I'm sure somebody remembers this. Some centennial or something, and the midgets were in Gravelburg. And oh, anyway, enough said. Anyway, the good-looking guitar player. So the next time, or whenever he was playing and I was dancing, I struck up a conversation with him. And we started dating. And there was a lot of partying those days. I drank, he drank, everybody drank. I didn't really think there was anything wrong with it. He seemed to get a little irresponsible when he drank. But I just didn't think. See, I hadn't grown up with alcoholism. I hadn't even seen it. I had a neighbor across the street, and we were told to get off the street when Jim was coming home. His truck would weave back from the farm down the road, and the truck would stop. It was all dented and dusty, rusty, and his yard was a mess. He lived right across the street. Door would open. A few minutes later, he'd fall out, sometimes climb out, crawl through the yard, hardly walking. We thought, whoa, weird behavior, very puzzled. But we knew by the look on my mother's face it was disgusting. She just, and we weren't to talk about it or nothing. Anyway, he died sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's all I, any reference to drinking, that's what I thought alcoholics were. So I'm going out with the lead guitar player and dancing up a storm, and 8 months later I'm pregnant. And I can, when we had also taken this show on the road, and we ended up in Humboldt. My parents were delighted that their daughter was bringing her show to town, the go-go dancer, right? And I couldn't really understand that because I thought I had arrived. It's difficult for me to talk about some of this. But anyway, I'm pregnant, and we're home for Christmas telling my delighted parents. And they kept telling me, he's really not the man for you, but oh no, I was in love. I really did love him. And he was a very loving, devoted, really a nice person. But when he drank, he just turned into something else. We got married, and I figured, well, we'll get married, have this child, we'll have a home, everything will be fine. He'll stay home. He'll be responsible. Wrong. He continued to drink. I stayed home. I was terrorized. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't talk to coworkers. How could I tell them I'd made a mistake? I went to my doctor. He prescribed Valium. Took those for a while. That didn't help. Didn't stop him from drinking. I also went to a lawyer. He told me to leave before I had the baby. I didn't want to leave him. I loved him. I would phone my parents. They wanted me to come home, live with them. Well, they didn't want to do that. So I was all alone and scared to death, just scared to death, all the what ifs. What if he wrecks the car? What if he has an accident? Oh, well, what if he comes home? What if he doesn't come home? I was terrified. And I wanted my marriage to work. We would have talks. He was a binge drinker, and we'd have talks after he sobered up and he was remorseful and he'd promise never to do it again. And I believed him. And my heart broke every time he went out. I can remember one time the baby was screaming his head off, and I didn't know what to do with him. I think I'd given him three Animas because I thought he was constipated. My husband had a family, or came from a family of 12, so he was quite comfortable with this baby and very excited about him, actually. And I told him to go and get a soother. He disappeared for 3 weeks. So I was forever watching him. It was like I had to put him on a leash. One day, I phoned, I don't know where it came from, must have been divine inspiration, because I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I phoned the center in Regina, and I found myself talking to a man named Tom, and I said, you know, I am very concerned about my husband's drinking, and I don't believe he's an alcoholic, of course, he's far too young, he's this, he's that, and he said, well, what do you think an alcoholic is? And I described Jim. Well, he said, I'm not like that, and I'm an alcoholic. Why don't you come and have a talk with me? So he said, bring your husband if he'll come with you. So off we went. And we were sitting in the office, and I was all ears because I wanted to know how to stop this behavior. And there was a soft knock at the door, and Martha Houston poked her nose in, and she went like this. And I thought, what's wrong with her? What, you know, she wanted me to go with her. I didn't want to go. I was going to have to supervise this man. I needed to know what to do. And she wasn't leaving without me, so I had to follow her. And she was obviously totally confused because she started talking to me about going to meetings. Now, good grief. I was working. I was cleaning the house. I was pregnant. I mean, what more could I do? Now I'm supposed to go to meetings. I'm not drinking. And I wanted to get back in that room and find out what he was being told. And she wouldn't hear any of it. She kept talking to me about my feelings. Well, all I knew, I was scared to death. Absolutely scared to death. She just wasn't giving up talking about me. She was handing me a bunch of pamphlets. I wasn't interested. As soon as I could get away from her, I was back with Tom and Gord, my husband. And we left that meeting, and he was told to go to meetings, and we left fully prepared that he would go to meetings. I just tossed the idea that I would go out the window. And so we went home. He started going to a few meetings, but he continued to drink, and I didn't go to meetings. It was far more important to stand at the window and watch at night, watch for that truck coming home or the car with no fenders or whatever, and, you know, it would park in the parking our stall, and I wouldn't rush to the door ecstatic to see him. I'd jump into bed and pretend I'd been sleeping for hours. I don't know where I learned that. I did it. Or I'd get a cab and I'd go downtown, way out here, looking for him. I'd run in the front door, he'd run out the back. I can remember one night we were creating a ruckus downtown. I'm screaming at him. He kicked the parking curb through his watch and disappeared into the night. And I thought, well, this is crazy. I'm crazy. Why am I doing this? So I went home and I thought, you know, I'm going to have to go to a meeting. Martha kept phoning me. You know, this program is based on attraction rather than promotion, and she certainly had it wrong, but she must have thought I was a keeper. I don't know. And she kept phoning me. Have you gone to a meeting yet? No. How are you feeling? Well, nothing had changed, of course. So I thought, I'm going to have to do something. I'm going to have to do something. Can't go on like this. So when I was working in the medical clinic, I saw many pregnant women, and I made up my mind that I was going to look good when I was pregnant. I had long hair from my go-go dancing days. I had stopped ironing it. And I had it all curled up on my head. And I had a hot pink and white maternity dress. I also had gloves, white gloves. I wore those to church in my other life. And I had a matching purse and shoes from my other life. And I thought, I'll get all decked out and I'll go to this meeting. And I won't show them that I suffered. And I thought, you know, from what I knew about this disease and the families that lived with it, I thought I would find Well, you know, I hate to say what I thought I would find. Pained, drained faces. Nails chewed to the, what, quick, my mother used to say. Long hair on their legs. Long, scraggly, gray hair. Bare feet in old, tattered shoes. And so I get in my car with no matching fenders. And off I go to the meeting. I don't remember if I talked to anyone about meeting me there or not. And I get on a small bridge. It wasn't Albert Bridge, but I was on some, I don't know where it was, maybe Elphinstone, somewhere in there, and the car stalled. Now what am I going to do? There I am, looking like an idiot, I'm sure. Out to here, hot pink, white gloves. And a cab came along and asked me if he could give me a hand. He looked, I mean, I must have looked out of place. And we couldn't get the car started. So he said, well, where were you going? And I gave him the address. And he said, well, hop in, I'll give you a ride. And I said, well, I haven't got any money. That's okay. Come on, I'll take you to wherever you're going. Off we went to the Al-Anon meeting. Well, he didn't, I did. So we get to the church, and downstairs I went. And I heard all this laughter. And I thought, God, I'm at the wrong place. I know I don't have a car. I have no money. What am I going to do now? But I thought, well, go in, you fool. You got here. Go and see what's going on. Walked in, and I was met with people just like you, mainly women, beautifully groomed, laughing their heads off. I thought, I have to be in the wrong place. I have to be. And they all rushed toward me, welcoming me. And I was just completely overwhelmed. So I sat down, and it was all gobbledygook. Never made any sense to me at all. I thought they were a weird bunch. One of them was laughing about pawning her husband's golf clubs to feed her kids. And her husband wouldn't ask, because obviously he probably thought he lost them. And so then, when she had money, she'd buy them back. And they'd reappear in the garage, and he wouldn't ask. That was strange. I'm going to learn how to do this. How is this going to help my husband quit drinking? And that's all I wanted to know, was how can I stop this behavior? Anyway, I went to that meeting, and I met women. I still remember their names today. It's like yesterday. I went home, and I don't believe I went back. I may have gone back to one or two meetings, but I just figured I could do something. I learned about the disease of alcoholism. I learned about the three C's. I didn't cause it. Well, that was just common sense. I didn't cure it. I'm not going to cure it. That also, to me, was common sense. But the controlling, I figured I could still do that. And I tried everything under the sun. If I would lose weight, if I would cook better, if I would this and that, nothing worked. Off he went. So one day, I'm washing dishes, I look out the window, and there, behold, was a bunch of women. Coffee pot, coffee, the whole cookies, the women from Al-Anon. They were breaking that tradition, too. And they were coming to me. If I wasn't going to come to the meeting, they were coming to me. And I learned later that one of them, Tilly, lived across the street, and she had orchestrated this. And in they came, and we had a meeting. And those gals hung on to me. Thank God they hung on to me. I was also terrified that when it came time to have this baby, I would be left alone. I would be alone in the middle of the night or something. And they assured me they would be there for me, just a phone call away. And so I started spending time with Tilly across the street. She was as skinny as a whip, and she smoked rolls of cigarettes, and she had blonde hair, and she stomped around the house in her bare feet, and she had lots of kids and a sober husband, and we talked the steps over and over, and she listened to me on and on and on. And when I had the baby, my husband was there to take me to the hospital. He disappeared soon after. I got a card from his mother, congratulations to the graduate. What that was about, I don't know, but anyways, it's in the baby book. I don't know why I said that, but anyway, the story of my life. And Tilly helped me mother my child, helped my little boy. So now I didn't have to be alone. I left the watch at the window. I started to sleep, whether he was there or not. What a gift, just to be able to sleep. So, I'm losing my place in my notes. By the time Tom was born, I was going to meetings pretty regularly, and I had no trouble admitting I was powerless over alcohol. And my life was certainly unmanageable. Now, I had been raised Catholic through all of this, or not through all of this, and I'd sort of walked away from that. I thought that I had just been written off by God, and I had the God I'd been taught to fear, actually. And I now began to believe that a higher power could actually restore me to sanity. You know, just to be able to sleep was sane. As I said, I was learning alcoholism as a disease. And I was also learning how to turn my will over to the care of a higher power. And also to turn him over. He's still traveling with the band and so on and so forth, and away a lot. And by the grace of God, nothing happened. My sponsor also started teaching me the slogans. Easy does it. My God, there was nothing easy does it in my life. It's all or nothing. And let go and let God. Live and let live. And my husband came from a big family of drinking and chaos. And I wanted to get in there and fix them. I was phoning the social worker, and I was phoning the truant officer, and I was phoning the RCMP, anybody that would listen to me to correct this family, because we're all going to end up in jail or whatever, right? None of my damn business. I just backed out of it. I had what I had to look after at home. So that relieved a lot of stress. I began to see things were changing. I could go to work. I feel pretty good. I make sure my little boy was looked after. I stopped creating drama to the extent, anyway, that I was before. I think I can still create drama. And I never rushed into step four. It took me a long time to look at that. There was nothing fearless about me. It took two geographical moves, another child, a divorce, a new sponsor, before I was really ready to look at myself. And I was consumed with guilt, too, at the failure of this marriage, and I was terrified of being alone. And I had no trouble listing defects, but she also taught me to look for the assets, because there has to be good things, too. And my step five, I grew up as a Catholic. I went to confession. It was nothing for me to go and do this with a priest. We burnt it, I remember, it was quite dramatic. And we did step six and seven at that time together. And now I felt, oh, great, I can get on with my life. Great, I got rid of him. He was the big problem. Nothing really wrong with me. I actually started to think this. Sold my house, bought a condo. And no sooner we'd gotten settled in our new home, I was made aware that a neighbor boy was sexually molesting my three-year-old girl. And at about the same time, I started dating the man who was quickly going to become my husband. I mean, I left Al-Anon, so I started some stinking thinking, right? And I stopped attending meetings regularly. I made a lot of bad choices. And without elaborating on the next few years, this is where I qualify for AA. I'm a double winner. I'm not going to tell you that story today. Now, when I finally made it back to you a few years later, I was sober, and I was remarried, and in deep denial and disbelief that I might have married another alcoholic. And why would I ask that? Why would I not think that I would? Because statistics say we do. Only this one was different. He was a workaholic alcoholic. He had money. The other one I had to chase all over town. It was like trying to herd cats to get the rent paid or buy groceries. This one had money, and he was willing to spend it on me and my kids. And now I'm back at step one, learning all over again that I'm powerless over alcohol and another's behavior. And getting back in touch with a higher power, and again doing the inventory. And my step eight was not a long list. It was mainly my parents, my children, my siblings, because I was forever minding their business and not mine. I had to back off that. And all they wanted to do was me to just mind my business. And my parents, I caused them a lot of worry. And what could they do? And I'm so glad I did my step nine. I didn't take time doing that, because my father had a sudden heart attack and was gone. And all he wanted me to be was happy. I didn't... Now, some people have been added to the list. I started a small business on my own during those wild days. And I abused people who worked for me, and I've had to go back and make amends to them. And in step 10, I continue to take a personal inventory and try to promptly admit when I'm wrong. And I've turned that around a bit now, because I am also wrong to accept abuse. And I promptly admit it. I don't let people abuse me anymore, even at home. If it starts, it stops, or I'm out of the house, gone. And the behavior changes. It takes two. It takes someone to act like that and someone to listen to it. I just walk away. Practice detachment, physical detachment, emotional detachment, and the behavior has changed. I also recall a situation that I couldn't get away with. I was parking my car in a no-park zone in front of a Star Rehab, I believe, where a bus comes up and takes people out of off wheelchairs and so on into the business. And I parked illegally. Why shouldn't I? You know, I got out of my car. This guy comes running. You can't park in there. And I, F-O. Well, I couldn't believe it. Where did that come from? Well, he scurried back into the building, probably thought, good grief, you know, this woman is either drunk or on drugs. I tried to cop a limp as I walked back to my vehicle, got in the car, mumbling and jumbling, but, you know, it only got that far. And I knew I had to make an amend. I had to apologize for that behavior right now. And I went and got my parcel. Of course, moved my vehicle, went and got my parcel and left. Driving away, I'm thinking, now, how am I going to do this? Well, I'll phone on my cell phone. That has no whatever name, whatever. They won't know who it is. And so I phoned. The gal answered, and I said, I'm the lady that parked illegally, and the attendant, your attendant, told me to move, and I screamed an abusive whatever at him, and she said, we don't have a parking attendant. And I said, well, there was someone out there that told me to move, and then he scurried back into the building. Oh, she said, that's Dr. So-and-so. He's probably with one of the patients. And she said, can I help you? And I said, well, I want to apologize to him. Silence. And I said, that behavior was totally uncalled for, and I need to apologize for that. Well, she said, people are always parking in there. No one ever is called in to apologize. Right away, the mind, well, why am I? You know, and just to shut up that committee of you-know-who there, I can't get away with that behavior. Well, anyway, I just said, relay my apologies to him. It was totally uncalled for. And off I went. Now, in step 11, this is my favorite step. I like to do steps 3, 7, and 11 together. And I especially ask for the power to carry it out. The power to turn my will and my life over to the care of God in step 3. Just the power to do that. Because I fight that. I want to be in control. And, of course, step 12, having had a spiritual awakening, I try to carry this message. And by speaking, when I'm asked, sponsoring newcomers, sharing with members, chairing meetings, and sometimes going on a 12-step call, answering phones. Now, before I came to you, I wanted to be a lawyer, but I was never able to go to school. Pregnant at whatever I was, 19 or 20 years old. And, not go to school so I could sit in the courthouse and listen to Mary Batten. I want to be a lawyer. So anyway, I decided now I'm remarried, I can go to school. I can do this. Because I quit my job, sold my house, and married him. I was living with him in 2 weeks. I mean, weird behavior. But anyway, that's another story. So at 41, I started university, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And 11 years later, I come out of there with a double honors degree in sociology and philosophy, and a master's in criminology. And I have you to thank for that. Because I was dumb as a bucket of bolts in school. I was ridiculed by teachers. I was probably voted the least likely to succeed, except in, well, who knows what, politics maybe. Oh, shouldn't say that. Anyway, the day I was graduating, my mother flew over the city in an Air Canada jet on the way to Toronto to a baseball game. That's how important that was to her. But it was to me. And there were many of my Al-Anon friends in the audience when I received those, whatever they are, certificates in Latin that nobody can read. Now, when my 13-year-old daughter was, when my daughter was 13, she was sexually assaulted. Now, she had just recovered from the previous episodes when she was a little girl, 3 and 5. This happened quite often, actually, but this was the biggie. And it was a close family relative. And I wanted to kill him. Thank God for this program. Because she started taking drugs. She was trying to kill herself. She was taking my husband's drugs. He's in the medical dental profession. Pills everywhere. And I never ever thought to get them out of the house. They were his. If he wanted to go on a trip without leaving the farm, that was his choice. But she got into them. And she was taking pill cocktails. And I would find her stoned on all this stuff. What's wrong? I just want to die. She had very short hair. She let it grow, hanging over her face. All kinds of things that I know now were symptoms of abuse. And she wouldn't tell me. So finally, I phoned one of the gals in AA, and I said, I've got this problem with Jen. What do I do with her? She said, get her into treatment. Took her to SADAC. She's a psych case. She's not an addict. Couldn't get much help. But anyway, I phoned Esteban. They said, if you can keep her straight for 3 weeks, we'll take her. So off we went to Esteban. And I had a funny episode there, too, because she was there one night. We went in the next morning to see her. She was flatter than a mackerel, stoned. And I phoned the doctor. I said to the nurse, what's going on? Why is she stoned? 11 o'clock, still in bed. Oh, they gave her Ativan. Well, I had kept her almost in my room for 3 weeks. And then I took her there and they gave her Ativan. So I got a hold of the doctor and I raised the roof. Well, anyway, we ended up being quite friendly by the time she got out of there. But in her treatment, it came out that she had been sexually assaulted. And it's her story. She knows that Al-Anon and AA has saved my life, and she's given me permission to tell you anything about her. Because without these programs, she wouldn't have me. So, fortunately, we were in that rehab center with her for her family week when this news came out. And I was staying at the convent. My husband was with me. And there was a Sister Adelaide there. And she sat up with me all night in the chapel, praying and crying about this issue and what we were going to do. So she told me, it's happened to her, not you. And it's her decision. She's 16 now. It's her decision what she's going to do about this. And you to support her. And that's how we handled it. It went to court, and that's another story. Now, my children were I'd walk on fire for my kids. My son went to Vancouver, and I tell you these stories because with them happening, I didn't do anything insane. I didn't buy a gun and shoot the rapist. I could have ended up in Pine Grove. I used to tell my children I wanted to be a lawyer, and I said, someday I'm going to be a lawyer, and I'm going to be in that courthouse. And my son said, you should be more specific, Mom. The way you live, you could end up in Pine Grove as an inmate, not a lawyer. Anyway, my son was in Vancouver working, and he was out celebrating his engagement with his fiance, and they were coming out of a dining room. A fight broke out. He was standing watching the fight. He wouldn't fight his way out of a paper bag. And when he was a little boy, I got him a big brother, and I wanted the big brother to show him how to stand up for himself and fight, and it was hopeless. The guy, Tom just wasn't into that behavior. Well, anyway, he got socked in the face, he fell back, kicked in the head, and he was in a coma for 3 days. And while I had just had a back surgery, and I was in the hotel staying across the street, and I had flowers and phone calls. They had no more room for flowers at the hotel from Al-Anon people. Phone calls and prayers. And he made it. He was okay. He's a mortgage broker today with his own business. That's a miracle. So who knows when you come to this group what life has in store for you. And it's held me up through so many things. Now, today, my children are both responsible, loving parents, and I have three grandkids. There's been a lot of healing and forgiving in our family. Those grandkids are my pride and joy. And now, another thing that happened, my ex-husband, after about 25 years, came back into our lives. And because of this program, and you in it, I did not badmouth him when he left. All I said, he chooses to drink. He doesn't love you. I was told by a psychiatrist to tell them that, because otherwise they'll grow up loving people who don't love back. And so I just said, he doesn't love you. He chooses to drink. He's sick. Well, I can remember him pounding on the window trying to get in when my son was about 4, and I said, he can't come in, he's sick. And Tom, when he got sick, thought he had to be outside pounding on the window. So he had to be a little more clear with things, which I'm not always so. Anyway, I hadn't bad-mouthed him, and I thought, well, now I wonder how this is going to work out. There's no relationship. There's nothing. The good thing that came to me one day, he was going down memory lane, and of course he was in a fog. I remember it all. And I started telling him that I thought, why am I doing this? This is ripping another hole in my soul. So I said, I'm not going to tell you all this. You missed it. I was a front row seat. I'm not going there. It's not going to serve any useful purposes. But I said, why didn't you phone me when you sobered up? He quit drinking on his own, and I always said, if you ever sober up, call me. I was too ashamed. The good thing was, he told me I had done a really good job with the kids. Now, I needed to hear that from him. In any case, they have talked on the phone once in a while, but there's no relationship. The kids don't understand how he could have just walked away and never had anything to do with them. I didn't keep him from coming to see the kids. But in any case, that's the way it is. Now, how much time have I got? I wanted to tell you a funny story. Al-Anon has given me courage. It's given me so many gifts. I've had very close friends. I have sponsors. I have a sponsorship sponsor. And I'm looking for a financial sponsor. Because, you know, I seem to trade one addiction for another. And, you know, if I'm addicted to an alcoholic, I'll sort of figure out how to handle that in my life. And then I'll find another thing. And I spend too much money. And I have to admit that to you. And maybe if I do that, I can't deny it, right? I've learned that in this program. The program has given me serenity, journey to serenity. I'm still on that journey. But it's also given me freedom. And freedom to just be a human being among the rest of you. I have as much right to be here, and freedom to do fun things. When I came to you, people asked me, what do you do for fun? I had lost me. Fun? What's that? Had no idea. So now I'm married to this fellow who's an academic. He travels a lot, and so I get to go along like a flea on a dog's back. And it's all arranged, of course. You know, if it's Tuesday, it's Belgium. And we go back and forth to Japan a lot. And some of you may know they have spas, hot spas, where people go in the water naked. It's segregated, of course, thank God. And it's a funny thing that I didn't get that mixed up. But anyway, I thought when I turned 50, I'm going to do this. Because I'd gone there many times and would never take my clothes off. Good grief, those women are so tiny, their bums would fit in teacups. And I thought, I'm going to do this. So off we go, and my husband and his friend goes the other way, and the fellow that was his friend took me the other direction. Not the fellow, his wife. Well, actually, he tried to take me the other direction, just as a joke, but because he calls me a little sumo wrestler. Anyway, we went to the women's side, and I tried to look as if I've done this 100 times. Anyway, I go into the room, you take off all your clothes, you get 2 towels. One's about the size of our hand towel, and the other, well, a face cloth, I suppose, and I don't know what you're supposed to do with that. But the big towel you have to leave behind in a locker because you come back out and you need to dry off, right? So that towel goes there. So there you are with your wherewithal going through the doors. It's a big fan blowing. And into this room, and the one wall is all mirrors, and there's women sitting at little stations, like at a beauty salon, and of course they have shorter legs, and so they're sitting on little stools. Now I said they're little stools, but they said it's not the stool that's little, our bums are big, right? So anyway, I thought, well, okay, I'll find an empty spot, and I planted myself on a stool, and in each position there's a little plastic tub, a handheld shower, a bottle of body shampoo, a bottle of hair shampoo, I think that's about it. And you soap yourself all over, and then you rinse yourself off, and then, of course, you go in the hot tub or the hot spa outside. So, of course, I start doing, and of course, I can hear the little kids, the little girl, oh, Wokino, which means, isn't she big? And the mother is going, shh, you know? And it's funny, and they're trying not to look, but I know they're looking. And so I sit down, and I'm doing this production, and the lady that brought me there is looking down, and she comes flying across down the road, waving, yay! I'm using the wrong shampoo on my body and my hair. It was the reverse. They're different colors, I guess. I don't know. Who cares? Anyway, it's a ritual. So she soaps me all over again, or gets me to soap myself with the proper stuff, and she's scrubbing me with this big brush, and my skin was as red as this. And then, of course, I'm to rinse myself off, and she goes back to her stool. I take the thing to spray myself off, and of course I'm soapy all over. Off the stool I go, bare bum, onto the marble floor, legs in the air, spraying everybody with this. Can you imagine? Oh my goodness. Well, anyway, I'm sure I was the topic of the conversation at many dinner tables that night. And then out to the, I finished this production, put that little face cloth on my head, and walked out to the spa and sat outside in the hot water with the birds singing, and I had accomplished something. And what that did to me was so freeing. You know, it was an experience. Well, I'll never forget it. I'm sure a lot of other people won't either. Anyway, now, I have so much to be grateful for. When I look back, I have my children to be grateful for. I have a reasonably happy life. I travel. I also realized the dream of buying a cabin at a lake, and I can go out there and enjoy myself. And I guess one of the biggest things is learning to mind my own business, be a mother-in-law, wear beige, keep my mouth shut. And I have in-law children that are siblings, and it gets difficult, you know, because a lot of he said, she said, and going back and forth. But by God, if I didn't have this program, there'd be no relationships among those people. They're not too fond of me because I think it's untreated alcoholism and worse yet, untreated Al-Anon. But it's there'd be no relationship if I wasn't in this program, because I'm opinionated. I mean, you know, I'm a windbag, and I speak my mind. I tell it like it is, and the program has just taught me to wear beige and keep my mouth shut with some people. It's not important that they know how I think about everything. And my kids ask my opinion of things. I tell them if they don't follow it, it's not the end of the world. I don't get in a funk over it. And happiness. Somebody said today, who was it? Randy said he's happy. What a gift. I would have never thought I'd ever be happy again when all of this started. And I don't know where I am today. As I said, I'm still living with active alcoholism, and in some days it's not pleasant. And I don't know why I'm there. I've prayed for a long time to help me either get out or him to quit, but I don't dwell on that, because I just, you know, I give him to God like I did the first one. You know, what? I can't do anything about it. The only thing is I don't travel with him, because it can get pretty scary when you're in places like Brazil and somebody's screaming and insulting people. You know, I tell him. I think the program has taught me to be honest and confront him. But I know it. I can't change it. And I sometimes think if I'm to get out of there, I need to go to a counselor. Al-Anon isn't enough. I probably need to see someone. But I'm happy. My life is good. So if any of you are being disturbed by anyone's drinking, I would strongly suggest you try Al-Anon, because it'll give you, I can guarantee that your life will change. And you'll have tools to deal with all kinds of issues. And I thank you for listening to me. Thank you.